Hi, I'm Moshe, and I'm autistic.
I'm Leah, and I'm boring.
Welcome to Now You Know One Autistic,
a podcast about neurodiversity in couples, marriage, meltdowns, and making it all work.
The opinions expressed in this podcast reflect the experience of one couple and one autistic.
Nothing that you hear in this podcast should be taken as a medical opinion. And unless otherwise stated, no one is an accredited specialist in any of the many fields that comprise the autism spectrum.
But as someone who is on the autism spectrum, I feel that my experiences will be very valuable to many of you. Whether you're on the spectrum, a support person like Leah, or just a curious bystander.
If you think that you or someone you care about may be autistic, consult your family doctor. Hi, Moshe.
Hi, Leah.
How are you today, honey?
I'm great.
So we haven't recorded in a little while because it's been a holiday, right?
In Israel and in our own personal lives, we don't talk a lot about it, but we are Orthodox Jews, so we do observe the Jewish holidays, and it was just Pesach, or some people might know as Passover, which in Israel lasts a week. Two of the days are holidays, and the other 5 days are sort of intermediate days where they're kind of holidays, but kind of not. And
essentially, they're a vacation. So our children were home the whole time.
Yeah. And we love our children, and we love spending time with them, but they don't exactly make it easy to take time away. And because right now we're using very, we'll call it rudimentary podcasting equipment. So it's not like we have like the privacy to say, okay, so, you know, Mom and Abba are going to the recording studio right now, so we need an hour to ourselves.
So if you've been following closely and you've been sort of waiting with bated breath for new episodes, we do apologize. But there will be times, as Moshe said, as Orthodox Jews, that we just won't be available because there are sometimes we can't use electronics at all. And often, especially in Israel, our children will be off during those times.
We don't want to talk too much, at least right now, about, you know, Israel or you know, being Jewish, because it's not relevant necessarily to the content of the podcast, but we absolutely do want to get into it. And of course, if you have any questions or you want us to do an episode specific to that, then we could definitely consider it. Maybe that would actually be a good special episode.
I feel like it's something we would only do if there was a high demand for it.
For sure. So anyway,
talking about holidays.
Yes.
Segue, everyone, or as Moshe would say, transition. So it's a good segue into today's subject, which is navigating social situations. Because during the past week, we've had a lot of social gatherings to attend, right, Moshe?
Yeah. So the highlight of Pesach or Passover is the Seder. And in Israel, because it's only one day, there's only one Seder. And it's the first day of Passover. So we ended up going the first night to a large Seder that was put on, you know, by our synagogue. And if you are familiar with how a Seder goes, it's very ritualized, which, you know, I do very well with because of, you know, I'm autistic. Did you know?
I did.
Okay. So it's very ritualized, and there's a lot of, now you have to eat the thing with the whatever, and now you have to read this story, and now you have to do this thing with the wine, and it's very...
Conversely, it's also a very high social situation. Yeah. So for example, where we went, there were at least 100 people in the room, if not more.
Yeah.
All sitting together, all chatting, everybody having their own demands. And for me, it was especially challenging because I had both Moshe and Avram with me in this situation where it was loud and not necessarily everybody was organized and there was just food everywhere that you can't touch right now. Not to mention that by the end of it, we've all had 4 cups of wine, which you have to chug. Again, it's a ritual. We could talk about it another time. So the social lubricant is just there and then people become touchy. It's a whole thing. So we figured we already were discussing talking about social situations, but we thought that this would be a good time.
It's a great opportunity to, as Leah said, segue into the idea of neurodivergence, neurodiversity when it comes to social interactions. It's one of those stereotypes that when you talk to somebody and discuss the fact that you're autistic, one of the things that is often associated with autism and other neurodiversity is difficulty in social situations.
Yep. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about navigating social situations as a couple.
For sure.
What does that look like for you?
So the way it generally works in social situations is like when Leia and I go out, and if we have to interact with a lot of people, or if we're going to see friends, or if we're going to a large gathering where there's going to be a lot of people, particularly people that we don't necessarily know that well, I kind of wear Leia as a form of armor, and I will attempt to social as much as I possibly can. And then sort of when I feel a bit overwhelmed, I will sort of tag out.
He does this really adorable thing where I'm about 4 inches shorter than him, and he can move me around sort of at will. So he'll do this thing where he'll talk to people for a couple of minutes, and then he'll just sort of grab me and literally place me in front of him and say, "So anyway, here's my wife." And that's my cue to start talking, because I have much bigger threshold for social interaction than he does.
But the nature of these sorts of gatherings, and especially in the Jewish community, is there's very different roles that men and women often play.
Let's talk about that. I can't always be there. There are times ritualistically where there's literally a wall in between us, where I'm on my side with all the women and our daughter, and he's on his side either alone or with Avram, who's not much help in social situations.
Yeah, so that the wall that you're referring to is a mechitza, and it's often found in a lot of Orthodox Jewish synagogues. And if you go, like here in Israel, if you go to the Kotel, to the Western Wall, or really any religious site that we've been, particularly one that's quite religious, if you know anything about Jerusalem, it's hard not to find a Jewish site here that's not like the holiest site in all of the world.
Unless you're extremely liberal, which doesn't really happen here, there's always some kind of a separation. So the women will sit up higher and the men will sit down lower, or women will sit on one side and the men will sit on the other side. The thing that we don't subscribe to is when we're looking for a synagogue, is sometimes the women will be in a small little sort of bullpen enclosed area and the men will have the rest of the area. If that's what's happening, we don't go there.
It's a really interesting, and at least to me, and it's also a really involved topic. And if there's enough interest, I would absolutely love to get into our experience, because there's a lot of different nuances to our upbringing and to the different forms of Orthodox Judaism. But for the purposes of this episode and this podcast, what I will say is, because of the different roles and because of the mechitza, or the dividing wall, the expectation is not only that men and women are kept separate, but that they interact
with each other.
With each other.
Right. So Moshe, or men, will often be touching Moshe, or clapping him on the back, or clapping him on the shoulder, or wanting to talk to him, which he's not wanting to. And I can see this from the other side, because we can sort of see through, but there's nothing I can really do about it.
Yeah, it's unfortunately something, or fortunately, depending on how you see it, but it's something that I've had to learn to adapt to over time. Because if you are a neurodivergent and you exist in, I'll use the N-word here, if you exist in the normal world, that can be
You scared me there for a second.
That can be a t-shirt, actually, maybe. But if you want to exist in the normal world and function as a normal person, then the expectation is that you're going to interact. Because it's absolutely acceptable, at least as far as we're concerned, if you are the kind of person who just wants to be on his own and not interact with anybody and just do whatever you do and then avoid talking. But I'm not one of those people. I've always been a bit of a contradiction that way. So when I'm on the men's side, or particularly when I want to attend a service outside of the standard family services where Leia is not there, or the kids are not there, and I'm essentially on my own, then I've had to learn to adapt to carrying on basic social interactions. And it's a challenge, and it's definitely a challenge that I'd love to discuss, because this episode is particularly about navigating social situations.
So for us, another thing that's important to understand for us, and that's a challenge for people like Moshe sometimes, is that in our, it's not really religion, in our society, let's say, because Judaism isn't everything, right? It's a society, it's a people, it's a, in our society, it's absolutely acceptable to show extreme touch and affection between same gender people. Because a lot of it does have to do with separation between men and women. And you're not going to touch somebody of the opposite gender that you're not related to. Right. So on my end, the women hug a lot and sort of touch each other a lot and say nice things to each other, dance together. And on the men's side, it's very much the same, except maybe less hugging and more sort of like, hey, bro, punching on. There's a lot of physical affection between same gender people that you won't find necessarily in other social situations.
Different religious communities have different expectations of social interaction and different expectations of social contact. Our experience with Jews or being in the Jewish community is that there is a lot of physical touching happening, whether you're shaking each other's hands or you're slapping each other on the shoulder as a greeting, or you're dancing. One of the things that I've had to adapt to the more religious I became was the fact that Jewish men love to dance.
They're always ripping him out of his seat when he doesn't want to and making him dance around.
And I'm very much about the, I'm one of those people that sort of sits there like, don't look at me, don't look at me, don't look at me, because if I make eye contact, you're going to ask me to dance. And then eventually I get cajoled enough by Leia and Ryan and possibly other men in the community where they'll grab me or they'll like look at me and like, come on. And you don't want to be rude. I mean, maybe you do, but I don't want to be rude. So of course, I always submit to the dance. And for me, any kind of social interaction, someone, pardon me, especially someone that I don't know particularly well, or someone who I don't trust, and trust is a big thing that we've talked about in past episodes. If I don't trust you, it's hard for me to interact with you and sustain. And we're talking about things like eye contact, physical touch. I can tolerate physical touch and close contact with people a lot more with people that I trust and that I have a relatively good relationship with versus somebody who I don't know very well. And the expectation is it's this holiday, so we're all going to get up and dance and you're expected to take part in it, even though we've had maybe a whole conversation over the last 3 or 4 months.
Right. I kind of want to go off on a little tangent and then I'm going to bring us back to the subject, actually. So it's a very interesting thing for us because we also have become more religious together as you've been together as adults. But we also grew up together in a much less strict society back in North America. And all of my friends know him, right? All of my friends from back then, which I've kept friends for a long time in that neck of the woods, know him as sort of like, you know, my boyfriend from back then. And he would interact with them and he would hug them, like girls, right? So girls who are now women. And he would hug them and he would interact with them, he would touch them, whatever. And as he got older, he's in particularly really uncomfortable with touching women that he's not related to. So when we were back in Montreal, because my mom was ill, and I saw all my girlfriends from back then, what happened?
They all wanted to hug me and touch me and show the same level of interaction and affection that they had grown accustomed to when it came to me. And some took it better than others. Some took it personally, which was definitely a concern of mine. But it was a journey for me too, because this was relatively new information, because everyone who knew me before we went back to Montreal either knew me as not that religious or they knew me as I was religious. So they knew better than to ask me to do things that I didn't feel like doing. And I was not as forthright with my feelings, and I still felt that I needed to accommodate, which over time and with a lot of help from Leia, I've actually become more able to vocalize my feelings and not be uncomfortable in saying, I'm sorry, I don't touch or I don't hug members of the other gender.
But it was very hard because when we were all teenagers or even younger, you used to hug my girlfriends all the time.
Yes. And for that, we're talking an awful lot about religion in this episode. For that,
it's hard not to.
It was, I mean, why not? It's part of the whole thing. For that, it was hard for me because as an autistic, and again, one autistic, not trying to speak for everyone, I have a hard time with illogical things. And I was feeling, I am now religious. I don't feel comfortable physically touching other members of, you know, other women who are not related to me, like my daughter or my wife or my relatives. And I used to before. So is it fair? Is it fair for me to now tell these people, no, I don't want to?
And if you can believe it or not, that was a topic of conversation between us privately a lot. And ultimately, what I had to convince him is that it's absolutely fair, but you also have to really very much be honest about your boundaries now and not sort of wiffle waffle about it.
Right.
Like, because my friends weren't actually doing anything wrong. They were just interacting with you the way that they were used to.
I mean, there were some that took it a bit more personally than others. But for the most part, it really does have to be inconsistent behavioral change. And we discussed, now we're really getting into religion. We discussed the comparison between the concept that we were discussing, which in case you're interested, it's called Shomer Nagia, and the idea of kashrut, especially in the context of someone who was secular and decided to become religious later on, which we call Baal Tshuva or Chozer B'Tshuva. Again, irrelevant to the topic of today's episode, but it's mostly just fun facts. And what I gained from that, which applied in this situation, is if you were in a past life the kind of person who didn't mind eating non-kosher or you didn't mind some contact with members of the other sex, then it's actually kind of a higher level of holiness, if you want to consider it that way, that you're now taking on for yourself the idea that you don't do this anymore. More so, one would argue, than somebody who was raised this way forever, and this is basically what they know. Of course, I don't shake hands with a woman. I've never done it. Versus, yes, you're absolutely right. Several years ago, when I saw you, I would give you a hug, but I don't feel comfortable doing it anymore. And that's something that's very important to me because I'm taking that on myself.
Right. So I'm going to drive us back into the whole idea of a social situation. And yes, that's based in religion. It's hard to separate us from our religion at this point. However, that is an example of navigating a social situation appropriately versus inappropriately, especially a difficult social situation. So we've discussed about navigating as a couple where I'm there sort of to be a sounding board or provide guidance or stand in the way if I have to. We've gotten to the point now where I can sort of read Moshe and I know what I have to say. I just have to decide if it's appropriate to say it or not. And sometimes I won't. Sometimes I'll still let him deal with it because it's not appropriate for me to interfere like he's a four-year-old. But sometimes it is. It depends. And he's talked about sort of navigating social situations on his own, though it would be probably interesting for the listeners to know some of the techniques you use when you're on your own to navigate a social situation. Because to be honest, I'm not there, so I don't know.
So men, or at least the men that I typically associate with, and again, this is purely in a religious setting. Of course, it differs based on the settings that I'm currently in. Are very much on an intimate level. The men that pray together feel a kinship, which makes a lot of sense, and a lot of them know me.
Mm-hmm. And often whiskey is involved, and then they feel even closer, which is true.
Absolutely. So when I am in that setting, and only this setting, because there's different scripts for other settings, but when I'm in this setting, I've already accepted that there are going to be some people that will come up to me and interact with me. And in fact, it's almost preferred on my part if they do, because I don't want to be seen as rude or standoffish, even though I obviously am. But it's part of the nature of who I want to be. And it really is about a script, especially if it's someone that I don't know very well, or that I don't necessarily even, I don't want to say I don't like, but I'm not comfortable with. And it kind of goes like this. A person will come up to me and they'll say hi, and I will try to make as much eye contact with them as possible, because that's the socially accepted response for acknowledging a person's presence. And I will respond with a greeting. If they engage me in small talk, which I dislike, I'm much
greatly. He's underselling how much he dislikes small talk.
I'm a very direct person, so small talk is not necessarily my favorite thing, of course.
Do not talk to Moshe about the weather. Don't do it.
I'll say the weather's fine. What do you want? And they'll say, hey, how's it going? They don't care. They don't care how's it going. And if I try to tell them how's it going, they don't want to hear it. So I'll go, it's great. It's fine. How's it going with you? So I'll try to mirror them in that sense. If they ask me a question, I'll give an answer and give them a similar question to indicate that I am now connected with them in a social interaction, and we are now interacting socially. And I will let them do most of the talking. And most of the time, that will be fine. And if they ask me questions, I will respond. But essentially, it is a matter of engaging as much as possible without trying to come across as disinterested or rude. And I've developed certain techniques for that. The old adage is that if you have trouble making eye contact, stare at their forehead or stare at their nose. If they're not like paying super strong attention to it, it'll look relatively similar. A lot of nodding. Sometimes I nod a lot when people are talking to me. And it is something that I learned over time, that if someone is talking to you, if you nod periodically, it demonstrates that you're paying attention. And sometimes you are, sometimes you're not. I actually do that even when I'm not engaged in a one-on-one conversation. Sometimes someone will be talking to a room and I'll like instinctively just start nodding just because talking is happening. I must nod to acknowledge I'm listening so I don't get called out.
Got it.
And then if I feel overwhelmed and Leia's not there to like throw me a life preserver, then I will attempt to issue a statement attempting to exit from the social interaction.
Which has Tanaki. Okay, so what Moshe is talking about doing is, I'm done now, bye. And he's learned that he can't do that either. I'm leaving.
And I've learned some just based on my experience. Like, well, it's nice to see you. As in, you know, you hear the music and people are exiting stage left.
Yeah.
Or, I'd love to stay a little longer and chat, but I do have to go. Or, you know, my wife is expecting me at home, or I have to get the kids from the thing. And if I'm not there for the thing, then the thing is not going to happen. Like, things are happening and I have to be present to remove someone from a thing.
Exactly. So that segues again back into, we discussed being your partner's social armor a little bit.
Yes.
But let's talk about what that means. So here it says, when you're your partner's social armor. I figure that's a subject for me. What that feels like to me and what that looks like to me is very interesting, because I am handling my own social situations, right? So I'm talking to people and I'm interacting and I'm discussing. But at the same time, I'm also watching for him to look for signs of actual distress. Like, if he's just a little uncomfortable, I'll leave him here, because he has to practice.
It's important for me, and I welcome the ability to be uncomfortable, which, as we discussed in also past episodes, you don't want to accommodate too much. And we'll definitely get into the different types of accommodation and what's helpful and what's not helpful accommodation.
Right. So what he described as a typical social interaction is something that I'm absolutely used to. And I will do the whole, hi, nice to see you. How are you anyway? How are the kids? Okay, I got to go thing automatically. And it doesn't bother me. Whereas Moshe, he says it feels so fake. And I've explained, it's absolutely fake, but it's fake for the concept of being nice.
Exactly.
For making the person feel heard and understood. And then you can control the situation and exit it when you're ready to. And that is why I'm a very good social for Moshe. Again, he's just like, you seem to have an unlimited ability to social, which I don't, but I have a lot more than you do. So when he's done socialing, he's just like, have you met my wife? Meet me, you know.
Yes.
How I like to live in.
It's kind of like I compare it to that scene from Indiana Jones where, you know, you kind of deftly substitute the little idol from the bag of sand, and then you just kind of walk away with it. I'll like start a social interaction, and then I'll be like, "Leah, that's you know, you remember that happened to us, right?" And she'll start talking, and I'll be like, "Tiptoe backwards," and then before you know it, I'm no longer part of the interaction, and she's the one doing the talking.
Exactly.
And I've escaped. and I quite often don't have a boulder rolling after me.
Sometimes,
yeah.
But yeah, it's very interesting.
And there have been times. It's a
concept because it is much better than you say, I have to leave now, or I have to pee, or something like that.
Yes. And there have been times that I would try to be your armor, because I like to practice sometimes, and you'll be involved in a social interaction, and I'll just kind of walk up and be like, hi, I'm here now. What's happening? And in that instance, I'm not so much, you know, your knight in shining armor. I'm kind of your, you know, squire in crumpled tinfoil.
I'm actually thinking of one situation where I had told you I wasn't really sure about one of the women that I was interacting with. So when you saw her with me and talking, you came up to me and you went, everything okay? Eh? And she literally looked at you and said, Moshe, she's fine. Go away.
Yes.
So, you know, sometimes it works, I guess, and sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but I have to have more in my repertoire in order to save you. Not that you need to be saved very often.
It's okay. I'm one of those princesses that saves themselves from the tower.
Yes, you'll rescue yourself, you'll slay the dragon, and I'll make excuses about how I could have done it if I really wanted to be a part of it. Yeah. So the nature of social interactions when it comes to neurodivergence is an interesting topic unto itself. And when you have multiple nature of social interactions, when you have multiple levels of neurodivergence or autistics, is complicated because, of course, we're not monolithic. So my challenges with social interactions are different than Avram's.
Mm-hmm. Right. So also often I'm doing all that stuff, right? Maintaining my own social interactions with women that I've made friends with, watching for your social interactions. And if Avram's there, that's a whole other level. Is he doing inappropriate things? Is he running around? Are his pants pulled up? Is he eating something he's not supposed to? Did he get into the wine? So that is often what a social interaction will look like for me. We don't mention Raya, our daughter, a lot because she's essentially an angel. Like she's like one of those self-raising Chia kids, I guess.
But I mean, she's also present and she's wonderful. And I mean, obviously she has her own challenges, but she is for the most part okay as far as this type of thing goes. Although she does have a number of her own challenges socially, which...
She's what people would have historically called painfully shy.
Painfully shy.
Yeah.
Yes. And we haven't quite figured out why, or if it's just her personality, or if it has something to do with some kind of neurodivergency. And we very much like Raya to be a part of the podcast at some point, because she's definitely offered to be like a guest, which would be, I think, a lot of fun. I don't know what she would talk about, but I'm sure it would be interesting. And of course, Avram would be interesting for sure. So the nature of social interactions, as far as neurodivergency goes, like I said, it's one of the most common things that you often find when you're describing somebody who is autistic or somebody who's neurodivergent or somebody who is, you know, a little bit different in that respect, because along with some of the other challenges that neurodivergents often have, there come a lot of social challenges. Some of them are contradictory, because you'll have neurodivergents who are excessively isolating and would go on their own and just do their own thing. And then you have neurodivergents who are very, very social, completely uncontrolled social, like go out to random strangers and hug them kind of social.
Avram is one of those. You've brought it up many times. He's very popular, and he also has a lot of capacity for social interaction, but it's often inappropriate, where he'll go up to strangers on the street and talk to them. Or when he has a friend, he will spend every waking moment he has with that friend and not give them a break. Or, you know, just tell people inappropriate things that he doesn't need to say to them, et cetera.
Because socializing is kind of like a dance. It has clear steps that people expect. It has a strong middle, as well as a beginning and an end.
Whereas a neurotypical person like me won't necessarily see that. I'm just talking to people, interacting with people, and living my life. When you don't understand a thing, you sort of have to study it. And that's where, I guess, Moshe comes up with these techniques and theories that he has.
I have a really interesting relationship with time, as has been mentioned before. And I'm particularly interested in the concept of beginnings, transitions, and ends, and where those fit in. And my struggles with those particular things has resulted in some really interesting interactions, because I'm forever trying to understand how to start things, how to end things, and how to transition between things.
Oh, yes. So this is actually a subject for a much different podcast that we're not going to really get into, but intimacy is really interesting when it comes to that.
Yes. And the idea of intimacy actually, for me, works very similar to the idea of socializing, where I will engage in a conversation to the extent that I feel in my own mind has been sufficient. And then when it's in my mind again at an end, I'll just end it. And if I can't think of a way of ending it, I will just walk away. The idea of the outro of our podcast actually is hinged on the fact that myself and obviously other neurodivergents struggle with ending social interactions. So if they can't think of a comfortable transition, they'll just kind of walk away and just sort of hope that nobody notices. Where you'll be in the middle of a conversation and you'll just kind of start going toward the door. And usually they'll just kind of be like, okay, bye, I guess.
When it's a social interaction, it's one thing. When it's a romantic interaction, it's very different. And we're going to have probably multiple episodes about that.
Yes. So transitions, very important. And we can discuss the idea of a social battery that comes up a lot. It's a foreign concept to a lot of people, but for neurodivergence, again, this is without any concept of if there are studies or if this is a real thing or not, but I've always had what I consider a social battery. Sometimes it's 100%, sometimes it's 50%, sometimes it's 25%, and it can vary based on a number of external and internal factors.
Right. What happens if we let the social battery get to zero, though?
If we let the social battery get to zero, then I need to recharge. For me, recharging involves one of two things. Either I need time by myself to just shut my brain off to the extent that I'm able to, or I can hook myself up to a fast charger, which is you, actually, where if I feel like I'm overwhelmed, I just have to spend some time with Leia, and not that kind of time, but just, you know, being with her, being talking to her, just being in her presence. And I find that will bring my social battery up, and it'll kind of look like I spent the morning at this event, or alternatively, I woke up in a relatively, I don't know, we'll say bad mood. I don't like that term, but whatever. And so therefore, I'm already starting with a low social battery. And what Leia will do, where she'll say, all right, well, we have to go to this thing tonight where there's going to be a lot of people. So why don't we spend a couple of hours just kind of talking and I can like put my arm around you or whatever and get you to the point where we can go and you'll be able to
It'll operate. Often be one of our ideas. Sometimes you'll come up with it too. You say, can you just hold me for a while? And I'll know what that means. Or I'll say, why don't you come lie down and I'll rub you for a while? Again, not in that way, but physical touch is important.
If we make any more innuendos, we're going to have to put an explicit content warning on this episode. Just kidding. No, we're not going to do that. So the nature of communicating your needs is applicable. This is why we said the first and the second episode of this podcast was that communication, while we're going to do, you know, individual episodes focused on that, but communication is going to sort of be woven throughout the whole range. And really, there's no topic that we're going to discuss in however long this goes on for, hopefully forever, that doesn't have something to do with communication.
Yes, but verbal communication, physical communication, unspoken communication. There's so many different types of communication.
Right. And part of who I am, and this came like over time, was number one, identifying my strengths and weaknesses when it comes to social interactions. What I do good at, what I don't do good at, what I need to do in order to get through things, what I need to do in order to feel better at things. And that was a challenge because for a long time, I would just shut down and isolate and that would be it. And so we had to work on strategies, Leigh and I had to work on strategies of myself. And it became a matter of, okay, so you're isolating yourself now. What do you need from me to help you through this?
But now what you've kind of done, knowingly or unknowingly, I don't know if you've done it on purpose, is you've kind of built this mystique around yourself. Instead of being, wow, he's rude and annoying and I don't understand him. It's like, wow, I wonder what he's so busy about all the time. I wonder why he's so focused and quiet all the time. There must be something really going on here. It's honestly a much better picture of pain for people.
For sure. And this also goes into actually, I want to say, not the last episode, but the episode before that. We did an episode, which is actually very popular on YouTube right now, if you want to check it out, called Do We Creep You Out? And it's by far our most popular episode of this podcast, surprisingly. And it has a lot to do with the uncanny valley of autism. And we talked a lot in that episode. Check it out. It's available on all podcasting sites on YouTube. That have to do with why it looks really off-putting almost when an autistic person is really trying hard to human and why it's actually better if they sort of lean into their challenges, their neurodiversities, because what you end up with is, okay, I'm in a social situation, I'm expected to behave a certain way, I have to look a certain way. And then you go up to them with this really creepy look on your face and go, hi, how are you? And they're like, ugh. Whereas if you were just like, hi, how's it going? And maybe there'll be questions. Is there something wrong? No, he's actually autistic, so he sometimes struggles.
Because people will never ask you the questions.
Right.
What they'll do is they'll notice something and then they'll come up to me and ask me the questions.
Right.
And it often goes something like, is there something like wrong with him?
They'll use the R word a lot, which I think we've used enough for the first season.
No, they don't ask me about the R word. That would just be rude. It often goes like, is something like wrong with him?
Right. And it does come up.
Or is he okay?
Yeah. Is he okay? That I've heard a lot of that. If there's something wrong with him, or the more aggressive form is, what's wrong with him? And instead of just being like, oh, you know, he's having his tired and he's...
No, I'm actually starting to explain it because when people ask you, especially adults ask you something, they want an answer. And that's the truth.
Because by trying to hide your neurodivergency, your autism, as we've been taught to do, unfortunately, in the past, in order to function, because there is a certain level of functionality, right? Because you... you have to, we're going to get into, again, I'll bring it up again, but we're definitely going to have to discuss it, the concept of reasonable accommodation and unreasonable accommodation. And you have to accept reasonable accommodations, but it's unreasonable to expect somebody to just be rude, off-putting, arrogant, never wanting to interact with anyone, and just shutting down conversations unless
everybody to be okay with.
You know, if you're like an eccentric billionaire who creates their own technology or whatever, then you can kind of be a little bit more
off-putting.
Yeah. But if you're just a regular schmo like me, you kind of have to develop a baseline of, okay, so we're going to be at this place for a while and you're going to have to talk to people.
But in order for me to become your armor in that way, like when people do notice the uncanny valley and go, what's wrong with him? Mm-hmm. I'd had to get over an interesting concept of my own, which was not wanting to out you without your permission. And the reality is, as you became more comfortable with your diagnosis and yourself and accepting yourself, that became less of a thing for me.
It's really one of those things that we're told to do a certain thing, but it actually ends up harming us rather than helping us. Mm-hmm. Because as you would often tell me, like, why are you so ashamed of who you are? It's who you are. Like, just be you. Stop trying to be someone else, because it's frankly kind of creepy. And just be yourself.
Right.
And if people don't like it, well, I guess that's their tough luck.
Yeah, but there was a time where you would have been mortified if I portrayed you as autistic to other people.
And it's unfortunately one of those things that a lot of autistics struggle with, especially adult autistics, especially late diagnosed autistics, who kind of treat being autistic like, you know, it's something that we don't like talk about.
Right. It's one of those things.
Yes, because we were raised in a society where autism, again, equaled the R word. And it's not necessarily something that we're told that we can be proud of. Now, again, that having been said, you don't want to be unreasonably demanding accommodations, because certain things are accepting and certain things are not accepting, and certain things are reasonable and certain things are not reasonable. Going into a room where there's a lot of people and staying in one side of the room and letting people approach you and asking for, you know, certain allowances based on your own sensibilities is reasonable. Demanding that everyone, you know, lower their volume and turn the lights in the room down, and each interaction that they have with you has to be a maximum of 5 minutes, because that's as much as I can handle.
Right. Again, then you're getting into rich, you know.
You know, you're not the king of the world. You're just Moshe. Like, you don't get to tell people to turn the lights down so you can make a grand entrance and feel comfortable.
Exactly.
You know.
So I'm going to segue us into another subject that's really interesting, because as always, we're running out of time. We never seem to have enough time. Again, time is an interesting concept in our relationship.
We're going to do an episode just on time, and I guarantee you that episode's going to run over time too.
Right. So I'm going to segue us into a different thing. So Moshe has this thing, and I haven't done research or anything, but I'm willing to bet that a lot of autistics have this thing where they have a person, and that person is their person. It's their one person, and it's their security person. And how dare that person not be available for them at all times when they need them? So what I want to discuss is how to deal with when your partner wants you to themselves all the time, but you have other responsibilities.
Yes. And it's very challenging in our circumstances, because we did spend far too much of our life away from each other. So there's also the sense of, hey, you know what? You got to live your life away from me. Now I get to have you.
Right. I feel that way too, but in a more reasonable level.
Right. And a lot of it really does have to go with the concept of trust and comfort in autism. And autistics often, and I say often because, again, one autistic, they often have hyperfocuses that are related to either an idea or an object or a place or a type of thing. But it's actually relatively I don't know. I don't even know if it's common or uncommon. I can't say for sure.
We'd have to actually talk to other autistics and they'd have to be honest.
But a lot of the time it can end up being a person. And when an autistic forms a hyperfocus on a person, it can be a very healthy thing because instead of clinging to something that would not necessarily be, you know, socially acceptable or possible, you sort of have carrying around a Squishmallow because I like to squeeze it and whatever. I was the kind of person that always wanted to be in a relationship. And I was the kind of person who always wanted to have someone who I could depend on, because one of my challenges was that I never really had too many people in my life that I could 100% trust. And Leia has spent decades actually working on developing that trust in me. And to the extent that we had a lot of things to work through at the latest incarnation of our relationship, what we developed is very, very close bond. And that's why when I say something like, I need to lie down, or I need to be alone, or I'm overstimulated, I need to be away from all of this, my expectation is either that either involves Leia, or that it can easily include Leia and she becomes sort of the background for me, or actually will suit it. And when I'm away from Leia, a lot of the time I feel anxious and uncomfortable, which you could argue is my natural state a lot of the time, but it's not as much as it used to be. But it is when you have that security blanket, when you have that Squishmallow, when you have that, you know, toy or that thing that you like to cling to and hold that makes you feel safe, and that thing happens to be a person, then you need to discover that they're not like a Squishmallow. You can squish the Squishmallow and it's not going to be like, hey, you know what? I gotta go.
We have literally had some conversations where I'm like, do you know that I'm also a person with thoughts and feelings and needs? And you're like, oh, yeah, like I knew it, but I didn't know it.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Let's take a step back. And that's also a really interesting thing in and of itself. Sort of we talked about empathy and double empathy and stuff, but people in general tend to be the main character in their own life. And for autistics, I think that's just a little bit more intense in terms of they don't even necessarily understand that the other characters have their own character arcs, let's say.
Right.
And that's been difficult. But also another thing, the way it will look often is that Moshe just wants time to me or with me to himself and doesn't want other people interacting. The issue with that is that we have a family and we have children and we have friends and we have other responsibilities. So what does that look like? To me, often it looks like compromise.
So it really definitely does have to look like compromise, because Leia and I have a really interesting relationship, because again, I'll use the N-word here, in a normal cupper, we're going to leave that one in, we're going to leave that in, in a normal couple, cupper, we're going to put that one on a t-shirt, for sure. We're a great cupper. So in that's definitely going on a t-shirt. So in a normal couple, you have one partner has their interest and one partner has their interests, and then they have couple interests, and sometimes they're together and sometimes they're apart, and they have their lives and they just kind of live them. And unless you're in a like a codependent relationship or an abusive relationship, you generally allow for the independence of each person to be their own entity that allows them to live their life separate from the other. But it's not an exaggeration to say that I am never tired of being around Leia, and there's actually no thing that I could do that requires me to not be with her. And for me, that's got a positive and a negative, because when I, okay, so if you have a hyper focus on trains Again, I'm stereotyping here, and I'm very sorry if your hyper-focus is on trains. Trains are very fascinating, and it's not my particular focus, but we can definitely have a conversation about trains if you want to. But if you have a hyper-focus on trains, and you constantly talk about trains, and all you do is say, I want trains. You know about the Amtrak 742 has an engine that's like 2 kilometers? Anyway, the problem with that is eventually you end up in a situation where people are like, you know, I don't really want to talk about trains right now. So can we maybe talk about something else? But when instead of you're focused on trains, you're focused on a person, you have the same kind of reaction where you're like, I have to go do a thing. And you're like, but trains though, like I need you to just be you. Like, I need you to be with me all the time. And just like you cling to your idea or your topic or your focus or your interest, I cling to my person. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about other people. I want to talk about you and me and us. Not in the weird, creepy sense. Just in the sense that sometimes I feel a certain way and I like Leia to be close. And it's oftentimes very sweet. And if she's not around, I don't always feel great. But it's gotten to the point now where she's able to go and do her own thing.
Well, let's talk about techniques. So when I'm not near you, I text you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I call you. I'll send you like memes and stuff that I like, or videos, or, you know, stories that I like and I think are pertinent. I will find a way to keep touch, even if I'm doing other things. And that tends to help, because what used to happen, honestly, is when I would leave for any amount of time and not keep in touch, then it would actually cause a fight, because I'd come back and you'd be in such a bad mood.
Uh-huh.
And then instead of us rejoining and enjoying our time together, it would cause a disagreement.
Right. And Leia and I would often actually have arguments that were based around the fact that I demanded more time with her. And I would say, of all the disagreements that a couple might have, the fact that they're fighting about wanting to spend more time together seems a bit strange on the surface.
Absolutely the sweetest fight ever. But in our life, with all the moving parts, sometimes it wasn't appropriate and we had to work that out.
We do. So now what we do is what I consider touch points. Because as much as I love when Leia will touch my shoulder or hold my hand or give me a hug or give me a kiss, or just kind of stand next to me, if it's not possible because of the busyness of our life, sending me a meme or texting me a heart or just looking at me and being silly or smiling, it's like she's hugging my heart, and it makes me feel better, even though we're not spending like the amount of time together that I'd like. And of course, there is times during the day or evening when we do put aside time where we're just...
That's another thing. That's another compromise. And both of us have a tendency to be a little bit insecure because of the amount of time that we've had to spend apart. And we're actually hoping that will go away as the years progress, but that remains to be seen. So another compromise we make is that we promise each other time later. Okay, so you're done this thing at 11 p.m. I'm going to put the kids to bed and we're going to spend an hour together before we go to sleep. And that will often make one or both of us feel a lot better.
It's also based on importance. And again, this might be a bit of a foreign concept to people that don't have the same attachment that we do. But it's basically like, I'm feeling like I need more time with you. Is my need for more time with you more important than what we're currently doing? If not, then can it wait until later? And if so, then can we compromise? I can't, you know, stay home tonight, for example, but how about we just sit and watch like a TV show for half an hour together? And I'll put my arm around you and we'll just spend time doing that. But then I do have to go. So sometimes there can be alternatives than just, I need you to drop everything and just be there with me. And it makes it a lot easier to operate.
Touchstones. I'll pour you, he works from home. So yes. I can see him and he can see me often because we're in the same space. So touchstones, I'll pour you a glass of wine and bring it to you. I'll pour you a coffee and bring it to you. Dinner time, you know, Raya or I will bring you food. those actually do help versus if you were out of the house, I think the coming back together adjustment would be more difficult.
Yes. And it's certainly a lot easier than it's ever been now. There was always going to be the initial feeling that what if I, you know, come home and she's not there? Or what if, you know, something is going on and I miss it? Or what if there was something that I needed to do, but I forgot? Or I decided I was going to go to synagogue and she absolutely needed me there with her for some reason that I wasn't aware of. So
I explained to him.
So there was a lot of that.
Too. I only need two things. I'm really simple where that's come through. I want him to wake me because he's an early riser and I'm not. That's always been the case, actually. So I want him to wake me and kiss me goodbye so I know he's gone. And then I explained to him, cell phones exist. They're a thing. If I need you, you're a 10-minute walk away and I have a cell phone.
Right. And it's definitely gotten a lot better. And like Leah mentioned, we have a family. So there's definitely a need for us to split ways and occasionally parent the children.
More than occasionally.
Yes. So we can't like spend too much time together to the point that Raya has mentioned that we spend so much time together that she misses both of us and wants to spend more time with us. And
so we have a ritual that when we're not working at night, we watch a show that we all like together. And she sits on the couch with us.
And it's actually really, it's an interesting topic that I would like to delve more into. And it has a lot to do with raising children as an autistic parent. Mm-hmm. Because as an autistic adult, you have responsibilities, presumably, if you have a family. I mean, the idea of calling it an autistic parent implies that you have children. I mean, I guess, in some respect. But if you're an autistic person and you have decided to enter into a relationship, and as often happens in the course of being in the relationship and doing the things that relationships involve, children happen. Mm-hmm. And then you have to get into balancing your needs as an autistic person versus your needs as the husband or the wife, I guess, of an autistic co-parent and being an autistic parent to a child, which may or may not also be autistic. Which is another interesting topic to get into.
We should do an entire episode on the genetic testing that we went through.
We will. And I would absolutely love to do that because we talk a lot about Avram, and of course he's autistic and I'm autistic, so we have an interesting dynamic. But a lot of autistic parents do not have autistic children. Like it's not a disease that we pass on to other people. It often happens.
The science is out on that, really.
I mean, yes and no. It's not a disease, period. I don't want to imply that it is.
It's not a disease, but it's absolutely genetic.
But it's not guaranteed, necessarily. It's
a 50-50.
It's a 50-50. And if you're an autistic parent and you have an autistic child and you have to deal with your own needs versus the needs of now a newborn infant, it can get interesting and as we say in Judaism, Bezrat Hashem, which means by the grace of God, we'll be discussing that more in detail at a future episode. And I'll leave that, I'll put that down for now.
As always, we've gone over, but there's one more topic that I need to discuss real quick. So let's discuss the appropriateness of when to rescue your neurodivergent partner in a social situation and when to actually let them hang there a little bit and be uncomfortable for the purposes of growth of themselves.
The unfortunateness of having an autistic child, but also an autistic adult, especially if you are the partner of an autistic person, is you have to love them. And of course you love them. Why wouldn't you love them? Autistic people are adorable. No.
You are.
But we're also developmentally delayed in some respects. And that is not one autistic. That is literally the definition of autism.
Yeah.
So When you encounter a delay, whether it's a social delay or an emotional delay or a physical delay or a psychological delay or some kind of delay, then you have two choices. You could either accommodate, and again, we're getting into reasonable versus unreasonable accommodation, or you can allow them to grow. And sometimes growth can look a bit weird, because if you are the partner of an autistic person and that particular autistic person struggles in social interactions and you end up seeing them in a social interaction and you know them well enough and you care about them enough to see that they're uncomfortable, you have to make a decision. Do I go in and rescue them or do I allow them to try and figure it out on their own?
Can I be honest with you? Whenever I'm making that decision, I always err on the side of letting you be a little bit uncomfortable. And I'll tell you why. It's not because I'm cruel. It's because I actually trust your ability to grow from being discomforted in a situation.
Yes. And this is exactly where we get into that little woven thread of communication, because we'll have a conversation, usually after the fact, and it's a lot more constructive now than it's been in the past. And I'll freely admit that. Where I'll be like, you know what, I was in that thing and these people were talking to me and I was really uncomfortable and, you know, where were you or like what was going on? And over time, Leia and I have had discussions and it's really sort of come down to, okay, so I wanted you to be able to figure this out on your own, because if you find yourself in a situation that makes you uncomfortable, you have to be able to say, I am no longer comfortable in this situation. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily say that to a person you're talking to because they'd be like, I don't understand what you're talking about. But you have to know what to do in order to get out of the conversation. And you can do it completely reasonably. It was great talking to you. I have to go. And then just walk away.
Yeah.
It's that simple. You can just scream, I'm leaving now, but that's less acceptable. And they might wonder.
No, but it's true. The conversations used to go, didn't you see I was uncomfortable? Where were you to rescue me? To now, I'd be like, I was kind of uncomfortable in that situation. And that was directly related to my response to you. Because when you would get mad at me, I'd get mad at you. And I'd say, I saw that you were uncomfortable. I also think you've got this. You need to try.
You have to try. And I am definitely someone who likes to challenge myself. I am a father, I am a husband, I am an employee to the extent that I am. I am living in a country where at this time I'm not fluent in the native language quite yet. So I'm no stranger to putting myself in uncomfortable situations. And that's what I want. And I've actually told Leia, if you have the option, I would actually like if you could allow me to try and figure things out on my own, because it helps me to grow as a person and develop my own ability to identify my own needs. And being able to identify your needs is applicable whether you're talking about a 5-year-old autistic or a 50-year-old autistic. It's all about, this is how I'm feeling. This is how I'm going to share that with other people, rather than stepping in and going, Moshe's done for the day. He's leaving now. No. Because then you're just allowing this autistic person to be in this permanent immature state where they never have to fight their own battles. And you constantly have to be there to, you know, manage them.
Now, the one exception I do have to say, and this requires you to be very attuned to your autistic individual, is if I see a meltdown is imminent, I will absolutely intervene. But you have to know the very early signs of them, and you have to understand what they are, and you have to respect them.
For sure. Because, I mean, there's helping your autistic person
grow. Because there's a point where you can stop it, and then there's a point of no return where you can't. And then you really don't want to be at a dinner party and explain why your husband is on the floor crying.
Right. Because, again, we had a conversation the other day, actually, about where, you know, being tough or being harsh or being firm transitions into being cruel. Mm-hmm. And if you are allowing your person, whether they be your child or your partner, to figure out a situation that makes them uncomfortable, and it's clear that they're not doing well and they need out, then that's not the moment to go, well, this is an experience for them to figure out. That's where you step in and you
because
say, okay.
A lot of autistics struggle with social interactions. That's been the entire, you know, theme of this episode. If a child is struggling to learn how to ride a bicycle, do you just give up on a bicycle or do you put training wheels?
Right.
And socially speaking, I feel that I'm your training wheels. Therefore, I let you go off and you know, bike to the best of your ability. But if you really can't handle the bicycle anymore, that's where the training wheel part comes up.
Right. So that is social interactions. And it's great to be back. And if you have any comments or concerns or queries or conundrums or complaints, definitely let us know.
Or even just want to say hi.
Yes. Our email again is contactus@nowyouknowoneautistic.com.
Literally everywhere on social media. Just look it up.
We're on YouTube. You can comment or like those. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Podchaser and a bunch of other ones. Basically, if you Google search Now You Know One Autistic Podcast, you'll find us somewhere. We get around. And yeah, so that's how that's going to go. Well, that's our show for today. Now you know one autistic just a little bit better. So something you know about some autistics is that we often struggle with ending social interactions. So, Leia?
All right, Moshe, I'll take care of it. Thank you for listening to Now You Know One Autistic. See you next week.